she goes, balance yourself like a bird on a beam. In the air she goes, where, there she goes. Up, up, a little bit higher. Oh, no, the moon is on fire. Come go the feeling in my flying machine. Going up, goodbye. One, two, three, now we're off, girl.
In 1937, Japan invaded China, and Pat Patterson had to leave Shanghai to establish his base office in Hong Kong. He'd been very successful in his aviation business, importing aircraft, allied parts, and equipment. For a change, he didn't lose everything, as he had the friendship and help of two very important men at the time, the chief manager of the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, Sir Vandeleur Graeburn, and Chiang Kai-shek's Minister of Finance, H.H. Kung. Pat had sold the aviation material to the Chinese government, and they were anxious to save it. Chiang Kai-shek needed the planes and equipment to build up his air force in order to unify the various provinces under his control, and he had to be strong militarily to achieve that. His competition was Canton, which had a separate air force at the time, bigger and better than the generals. There were two very experienced men running the Canton Air Force, one of whom had been flying since 1911. There are still a number of the Canton pilots living in Hong Kong today, as is the daughter of the former Air Force chief, General Lim. A way had to be found to get this valuable equipment out of Shanghai and down to Hong Kong. Taking a chance, they contacted the Japanese commander, who accepted a payment of $3 million to let the goods out, and Pat arranged for them to be moved from the warehouses, and they were loaded, surprisingly enough, onto ships by Japanese lighters. Pat saw the golden opportunity to add his personal effects, and everything was safely landed in Hong Kong. Guy Lombardo and his Royal Canadians, recorded in 1937. It was following this little adventure that Pat took the medical supplies and Mack trucks into China, as detailed in last week's program. Pat adds a footnote to this episode.
Unfortunately, I made pictures all the way, and I put together a complete album of it and sent it to the Mack Corporation, and they've lost it.
They did receive it.
Somebody's got it in their private file somewhere.
That would have made a book in itself, that
yeah.
One. When you said you were flying around China, I imagine also that flying around China in those days, you were by the seat of your pants.
Well, we got permission to import a small aircraft for our own transportation because in those days, transportation was by water was the only way we could go anywhere. And we got permission from the Air Force to import this plane, and then they gave us permission to put the Chinese Air Force insignia on the wing as long as it had a red border on it. And then they advised all the commanders of all the airfields that when we'd come in, as long as when they saw that insignia, they gave us fuel and anything else we needed and asked no questions.
Was there much radio contact out in the back blocks of China?
No, there was not. You navigated by the best way you could. Just there were very few maps. So there was a lot of dead reckoning. My partner, Mr. Leslie Lewis, in China, the Air Force decided that they had to give us a license, so we tossed up, and he got number one license, and I got number two, as a commercial transport.
The Americans were very involved in China at this time. They had agreed to run a training field in Hangzhou, with American pilots as trainers using the fleet trainer. Their greatest difficulties were political. The provincial warlords all had sons, nephews, or cousins who wanted to fly, and they would be sent down for training, regardless of aptitude. After receiving whatever training they could absorb, these sons of the provinces received a flying certificate of sorts. Unfortunately, it was these very pilots who were sent to fight the Japanese, subsequently losing all the good planes to the enemy through basic inability, and this seriously depleted the Chinese Air Force. Is this the time you talk about the American airfield when General Claire Chennault came on the scene in China?
Yes, he came on the scene just about that time. And we had been, all the American representatives over there had been trying to convince Madam Chiang Kai-shek, who was the chief of the Air Force, to hire someone, an American of proper stature, to come over and help get the Air Force into shape. They first sent a retired general over, and he didn't last very long. He had heart failure. And Chennault was... I had met Chennault when I was on a trip back to the States just the year before, and he was just told me he was going to retire from the Air Force because of differences between he and Harp Arnold, the chief of the Air Force, the American Air Force, on pursuit tactics. And I asked him what he was going to do, and he said, well, he wasn't sure yet. And I said, well, why don't you come out to China? There's a lot of things cooking out there. And he said, I've been reading about that. That sounds good to me. I'll come out. So he sent a cable and said he would be on the way at a certain date. But then this other condition developed at the time where the ex American general died, so that the request went in for a replacement, and Chennault's name came up, and the state cleared it, and so he arrived as a new advisor.
And there's the start of another story.
And there is. History goes on from there, yes.
That was Non-Stop Flight, written and recorded in 1938 by Artie Shaw. Brigadier General Claire Chennault was obviously a colourful and capable character. After 20 years with the U.S. Army Air Corps, during which he led a flying act known as Three Men on a Flying Trapeze, he wrote an aviation textbook in 1935 entitled The Role of Defensive Pursuit. According to what Chennault told Pat Patterson, it was his differences with the U.S. command over ideas expressed in this book that led to his resignation from the force. However, the Encyclopaedia Britannica states that Chennault was retired due to increasing deafness. He became air advisor to General Chiang Kai-shek and formed the American Volunteer Group.
He did organize a foreign legion type of operation that was composed of a lot of men who had been flying in the Civil War in Spain, and some down in South America and South Africa. They were a conglomeration of American, French, German, and everything else. So he had a very difficult time to organize them. And they were flying these airplanes, which were not the best, and the Japanese took advantage of them, shot a lot of them down. And that was before they had the identification on their back showing that they were of the American group. And so when the planes had landed in the farmlands, why, the farmers thought they were Japanese pilots and did away with them before they knew any better. So Chennault finally disbanded the whole organization and had to wait for a later day when the Chinese Air Force got the proper airplanes.
When was the name Flying Tigers formed? When did that come into existence as a group?
It came into existence when they made the Chinese operation official and became the 14th Air Force. Then they were able to also hire these Air Force pilots. They officially resigned from the Air Force so they could hire them for that particular operation. They came over to China as civilians, then were enlisted in the Flying Tiger. They operated that way for about a year, I believe, before the U.S. Designated the 14th Air Force, and they were enlisted back in the U.S. Air Force again.
They must have had to have had some incentive to leave the Air Force and come to China. Were they paid large salaries by the Chinese government?
Yes, they were paid considerably more than they would have been in the Air Force. And, of course, most of them came over because they thought it was a interesting area to operate in, and also some of them just had heard about these fantastic Japanese pilots, and they wanted to get over and mix with them.
So they wanted to pit their skills against
That's right. Oh, a lot of them did that. And of course, as history portrays, they did that. They downed some, I think, not sure of just the number, but I think about 2,600 Japanese airplanes.
After their outstanding success, the group was incorporated into the U.S. Army Air Force in 1942 when Chennault was recalled to active duty. He resigned in 1945. Contrary to popular opinion, General Chennault did not play any part in the formation nor the ensuing success of the commercial Flying Tigers air freight service. However, he did remain in China and, at the request of the Generalissimo, formed Civil Air Transport. This service was in existence from 1946 to 1949.
Of a very unfortunate color man who got arrested down in old Hong Kong. He got 20 years privilege taken away from him when he kicked old Buddha's gong. And now he's bobbing the piano just to raise the price of a ticket to the land of the free. Well, he say his home's in Frisco where they send the rice, but it's really in Tennessee. That's what he say. Need someone to love me, need somebody to carry me home to San Francisco and bury my body there. Oh, I need someone to lend me a $50 bill and then I'll leave Hong Kong far behind me for happiness once again. Won't someone believe I've yen to see that bay again? But when I try to leave, sweet opium won't let me fly away. I need someone to love me, need somebody to carry me home to San Francisco and bury my body there. That's the story of a very unfortunate color man who got arrested down in old Hong Kong. He got 20 years privilege taken away from him when he kicked old Buddha's gong.
Hoagy Carmichael and his song Hong Kong Blues from 1938. Back to the setting of Pat Patterson's study, and newspaper clippings featuring Pat with William Randolph Hearst II. Pat taught him to fly in Los Angeles when Hearst was about 19, and they remained good friends. There's also a photograph of another hero of early aviation, the Australian Sir Charles Kingsford Smith. Pat was involved when Kingsford Smith was planning the flight from Oakland to Australia. Kingsford Smith bought the Fokker Super Universal triplane from Sir Hubert Wilkins, who, on trying to make a North Pole flight, damaged the plane, and Kingsford Smith was able to buy it for practically nothing. However, there was a lot of work to be done on the plane, and Pat had just started a new company in Los Angeles, which he called Pacific Air Motive, which was the first company of its kind for complete overhaul and repair of aircraft on the west coast of the USA. They set to work getting the plane in order for the long flight across the Pacific, which took place between May 31st and June 9th, 1928. The plane, the Southern Cross.
We didn't know whether we were going to make it or not because he had very little money. And he had contracted with other companies to do a little work like painting and things of that kind. And when he didn't pay them, they'd go to the sheriff and make a complaint, and the sheriff would come out and stop us working. And we went through that stage for four or five times before we got the airplane in flying condition. And then, of course, he left and went to Oakland, where he took off for Australia.
Is it difficult to make the comparison as to who was the better pilot or the more adventurous, the American Lindbergh or the Australian Kingsford Smith?
Well, I think there was a slight difference because Lindbergh was alone and Kingsford Smith had this Captain Ulm with him, who was the co-pilot. Then he had a radio operator and a mechanic. They had some things happen to him on the way which were notable. One of the engines began to lose revolution because of an oil stoppage, and the mechanic climbed out in the wing and actually got to the trouble and fixed it in flight.
Yes, they made a film in Australia on the life of Kingsford Smith, and this was a very big scene in that film, and I remember how exciting that was and wondering if it really did happen, but of course, as you say, it did.
Oh, I think comparing the two flights, I think I don't think one could be considered any more courageous than the other.
Do you think there was a greater sense of adventure in those days than there is perhaps today, or is it just a different kind of adventure?
Well, I think the whole aviation business in those days was an adventure because the airplanes weren't as like they are today. We didn't have the radio equipment, we didn't have the instrument equipment, the engines weren't as reliable, so you were always faced with the possibility of an engine failure. And if you were had good luck, you were over someplace where you could land. If you didn't, why, too bad.
I imagine a lot of people would have considered you as wild young men.
Most people in those days thought we were crazy. I tried to borrow some money from my flying school one time from a banker, and he looked at me and he said, "Son, you fellows are crazy. How do you think that I can convince my board of directors to loan crazy people funds?" That was the attitude they took.
And I suppose it took the insurance companies a while to come around to insure you when you're playing.
Oh, the insurance companies wouldn't touch us.
It was on a flight from London to Australia that Sir Charles Kingsford Smith and his companion Thomas Petherbridge were lost en route to Singapore in 1935. Other famous faces looked on from Pat's wall, including that of Eddie Rickenbacker.
Well, Rickenbacker was, of course, flying as an American pursuit pilot in Europe during World War I. I don't remember the number of victories he had, but he became an American ace. And when he returned to the States, of course, he joined the airline, Eastern Airline, became president of it. He had one experience where he was, the airplane he was flying, I don't remember just the reason why he had to ditch it in the water. But they got in the rubber boat and floated around for quite a while until he found a book in the raft called the Raft Book. It was a book that was made by Harold Gatty, the famous round-the-world navigator. And if he had nothing but a Mae West radio and a watch and an oar, and you followed the directions in this book, even if you had no previous navigation experience, you could call and for help and tell him within a mile or so where you were, which saved his life. Harold Gatty later, after the war, was the originator of the Fiji Airways, which later became Air Pacific. I was one of his original partners, but unfortunately, he died after about 3 years of operation, he died of heart failure, and the airline was sold to Qantas, who later sold it back to the Fiji government.
The raft episode that Pat mentioned happened during World War II in the Pacific. Rickenbacker and his crew were 21 days in the life raft before being picked up. Rickenbacker was largely responsible for building up Eastern Airlines, and he became chairman of the corporation in 1953. He remained active in various public fields until his death in 1973 at the age of 82. I wonder if during those days in the life raft, Captain Eddie Rickenbacker and his crew whistled the music of Major Glenn Miller, who was sadly to lose his life on a flight from London to Paris in December 1944.
Hi there, Texas.
how's your new romance? The one you met at the campus dance.
Wait until you see her, you'll agree. My hometown gal's the only one for me. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I got a gal
in Kalamazoo.
Don't want to boast, but I know she's the toast
of Kalamazoo, zoo, 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 zoo.
Years have gone by.
My, how she grew.
I liked her looks when I carried her books
in Kalamazoo, zoo, 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 zoo.
I'm gonna send a wire, hopping on a flyer,
leaving today.
Am I dreaming? I can hear her screaming.
Hiya, Mr. Jackson. Everything's okay. A-L-A-M-A-C-O. Oh, what a gal. A real pipperoo.
I'll make my bid for that freckle-faced kid I'm hurrying to.
I'm going to Michigan to see the sweetest gal
in Kalamazoo.
Another aviator of international renown was James Doolittle, who later became General James Doolittle. The signed photo on Pat's study wall depicts a very handsome man in the years just prior to World War II. Doolittle's fame grew along with his decorations for planning the Tokyo raid. Pat takes up the story.
And that started in New York at my home. In a winter's night, and he and his engineering officer arrived about midnight, came out of the cold and had some food and a few drinks, and they began to work on a problem in my kitchen, on my kitchen table. And they worked all night on it. They didn't leave until 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. And then it developed that what they were working on was the possibility of using the B-25 bombers to take off a carrier to bomb Tokyo. The problem was that they wanted to figure out how much load and bombs that they could carry and still get off the carrier. So they went down to Florida and laid out a carrier outline on the runway down there and practice taking off with various loads until they found out what what the extreme load could be. And from a distance, certain distance from Tokyo. Unfortunately, a Chinese fishing junk spotted them before they got to the point of where they intended to take it off as far as distance is concerned. So they were forced to take off a little before that. And that resulted in most of them having to crash land after they passed over Tokyo, both in, some of them landed in Japan, and some of them made it to China and landed in China. But most of them, or many of them, were caught by the Japanese and were interned, even in China, because the Japanese had a large portion of that area. An incident about when Doolittle crash landed his airplane. And I forgot the name of the Chinese town in the north of China, above Tientsin somewhere. He walked to the airport nearby, where he heard the airplanes warming up and whatnot, and there was a C-47 standing there with engines running, and Chinese refugees getting in the door. And he walked up under the pilot's cabin, and when the pilot saw him and saw he was American, he said, "Get in, get in." He said, "We're overloaded now." He said, "Never mind, get in. As long as you can close the door, we'll get off." After a little while, he made his way up through the mass of passengers. And when he got up in the cockpit, he introduced himself as General Doolittle.
Johnny was a soldier boy who never looked for scraps, but this young buckaroo was Yankee through and through. Then Johnny heard our country's call to arms against the Japs, and as he marched away, his buddies heard him say, "Goodbye, Mama, I'm off to Yokohama for my red, white, and blue, my country and you. Goodbye, Mama, I'm off to Yokohama just to teach all those Japs the Yanks are no saps. A million fighting sons of Uncle Sam, if you please, we'll soon have all those Japs right down on their Japanese. So goodbye, Mama, I'm off to Yokohama for my country, my flag, and you.
Goodbye, Mama, I'm off to Yokohama for the red, white, and blue, my country and you. Goodbye, Mama, I'm off to Yokohama just to teach all those Japs the Yanks are no saps. A million fighting sons of Uncle Sam, if you please, we'll soon have all those Japs right down on their Japanese. So goodbye, Mama, I'm off to Yokohama for my country, my flag, and you.
Fighting sons of Uncle Sam, if you please, we'll soon have all those Japs right down on their Japanese.
So goodbye, Mama, I'm off to Yokohama for my country, my flag, and you.
That was recorded in 1941 by Dick Robertson. The kitchen table Pat referred to in his New York apartment, on which General Doolittle made his calculations, now stands in a study here in Hong Kong.
You've seen a lot of war from the age of 16 and various kinds of war, and you were manufacturing aircraft in the States when they dropped the atomic bomb in Japan. How would you classify yourself as anti-war, anti-nuclear bombs? How do you feel about it?
No, you couldn't be as active around it and be anti-anything. Well, I know. I've been in both sides of the business, in the commercial side and in the military and in the armament side. And it's a question that's very hard for me to answer. Naturally, no one likes to see war, but the method of preventing it is to provide the means not to have a war. In other words, to develop equipment that makes it very difficult for any country to decide to start a war.
I understand that part of it, but when you think about it and take yourself back to when the time you were 17 years old, flying a little plane over Europe, dogfighting, and flying your plane and aiming with its machine gun set in the nose, and here are you flying that plane as you're flying a weapon. And now when you think of the weapons just 60 years later, it is very frightening.
To me, I don't think it ever occurred to me.
You've just gone along with the evolution.
You did, or you got in trouble.
Down went the gunner, a bullet was his fate. Down went the gunner, and then the gunner's mate. Up jumped the sky pilot, gave the boys a look, and manned the gun itself as he lay beside the book. Shout and praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition, and we'll all stay free. Praise the Lord and swing into position. Can't afford to sit around a wishing. Praise the Lord.
There's a debatable point, but not for this program. I hope you'll join me, Maggie Britton, and my guest, Pat Patterson, next week for the fourth and final episode of this series.
Some goes a feel in my flying machine, going up, she goes, up, she goes. Balance yourself like a bird on a beam, in the air she goes, where, there she goes. Up, up, a little bit higher, oh no, the moon is on fire. Some goes a feel in my flying machine, going up, going up. Goodbye. One, two, three. Now we're off, girls. How's this? Pretty soft, girls. Oh, dear, don't hit the moon. No, girls, not yet, but soon. This for me. Oh, my, you're a shy queen. Not I. I'm a sky queen. Oh, I'm up in the air about this for a fair. Come, Josephine, in my flying machine. Going up, she goes, she goes. Balance yourself like a bird on a beam. In the air, she goes. Where, there, she goes. Up, up and it's shooting fire. Oh, look, the moon is on fire. Comes all the feeling in my flying machine. Going up, going up, goodbye. Comes all the feeling in my flying machine. Going up, she goes, she goes. Balance herself like a bird on a beam. In the air she goes, where, there she goes. Up, up, a little bit higher. Oh, look, the moon is on fire. Comes all the feeling in my flying machine. Going up, goodbye.